content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And this week we're reading from The Week magazine, dated November 2nd, 2012. And as usual, we will begin with the main story section of The Week magazine. Our first article here is entitled, A Combative Obama versus Moderate Mitt. What happened? In the third and final presidential debate, President Obama sought to regain his advantage by sharply questioning opponent Mitt Romney's foreign policy expertise. While Romney tried to assure voters he'd be a cool and steady moderate, not a hawk. The debate on foreign policy saw the two presidential candidates agree on broad outlines of U.S. involvement abroad, with Romney backing away from his previous harsh criticism of Obama's policies and of his handling of the attack on the U.S. consulate in Benghazi, Libya. Romney said he would only consider military action in Iran if all of the other avenues were blocked. He praised the president's use of drone warfare against al-Qaeda and his killing of Osama bin Laden, and he backed the withdrawal of troops from Afghanistan by 2014, while chiding the president for not doing more to win over the Islamic world. We can't kill our way out of this mess, he said. We want a more peaceful planet. Obama was more combative, accusing Romney of being all over the map on foreign policy and mocking his opponent's criticism that the Navy had fewer ships than at any time since 1917. Well, Governor, we also have fewer horses and bayonets, he said acidly, adding that the nature of our military has changed. A CNN ORC International poll found that 48% of registered voters considered Obama the winner, and 40% Romney. National election polls still showed the race essentially tied. Now here's what the editorial said. Romney proved in this debate that he has no original ideas of substance on most world issues, said the New York Times. On Syria, Iran, and Afghanistan, he merely parroted what Obama has already done or plans to do. As he fumbled incoherently, he kept trying to change the topic to domestic policy and his vague plan to create 12 million jobs. If Romney is going to convincingly complete the transition from severely conservative to agreeably moderate, said Bloomberg.com, he needs to get better at explaining himself. His foreign policy can be summed up as same as Obama's, except better. Obama may have won, said the Wall Street Journal, but he looked smaller doing it, scoring cheap debating points while Romney chose to look presidential. As the clearly desperate Obama kept attacking him, it was difficult to tell which was the incumbent and which was the challenger. Now here's what the columnist said. Suddenly, the neoconservative warmonger of the Republican primaries is milquetoast Mitt, said Harold Meyerson in the Washington Post. Romney spent the debate etch-a-sketching away his hawkish statements of the spring, assuring war-weary voters that he was no Bush-style interventionist, and mentioning peace, or some variation of it, a dozen times. It may be a flip-flop too far, said Alec McGillis in the NewRepublic.com. Shifting to the center on domestic issues may reassure swing voters, but Romney's 180-degree reversal on almost every foreign policy issue makes him look rudderless and adrift, instead of a safe alternative to Obama. Romney's goal was not to challenge Obama, but simply to show he's well-versed on world issues, said Fred Barnes in WeeklyStandard.com. He succeeded offering an analysis of problems involving several countries in the Middle East and a specific critique of the downsizing of our military. Liberals are just disappointed that Romney didn't conform to their stick figure caricature of him as a neocon itching for war, said James Taranto in WallStreetJournal.com. They called Reagan a warmonger, too, remember, even though he later won the Cold War, not by fighting, but by projecting strength and confidence. Judging from these debates, Romney seems to have learned that lesson well. Even if Obama did win this debate, said Roy Fournier in NationalJournal.com, Romney won the debate season. The Republican candidate appeared calm, rational, and presidential in all three debates, and thanks to a spectacular first debate failure by the incumbent, has proved himself a viable alternative to Obama. But while the debates have really mattered this year, said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post, the issues, not so much. No one really knows how Romney would govern as president or has a vivid picture of how Obama sees the next 4 years. As the election looms, we're as ill-informed as ever. The next item in the main story section is the Scouts' Shameful Secrets. 20 years' worth of secret records detailing allegations of sexual abuse by Boy Scout leaders were cast into public view last week, revealing that one of the country's oldest youth organizations systematically failed to report abuse and often covered up allegations in order to protect its reputation. Boy Scout officials had fought in court for years to prevent the release of the so-called perversion files. 15,000 pages detailing allegations of molestation by more than 1,200 scout leaders between 1965 and 1985. But the Oregon Supreme Court ordered the documents released with victims' names redacted, and many accused abusers now face public exposure for the first time. The secrets are out, said Kelly Clark, a lawyer who successfully sued the Scouts in 2010. Yet another institution has betrayed the public trust by protecting predators, said Don Esmond in the Buffalo News. As in the abuse scandals involving the Catholic Church and Penn State, leaders hid troubling allegations from authorities and parents for decades, thereby fueling the cycle of abuse. Sadly, these files are probably just the tip of the iceberg, said the New York Times in an editorial, since we don't know how many reports were lost or purged. The files also lay bare an appalling dissonance. Here is an organization that has fought bitterly to protect its right to exclude homosexuals, even while hiding sexual predators. The Scouts have made some recent progress in confronting the organization's ignominious history of sexual abuse, said the Los Angeles Times, but only a true independent review of remaining files, both public and secret, can establish that the Boy Scouts is no longer the organization that dealt with sexual abuse so inadequately for so many years. If there is any upside to this wave of abuse scandals, it is that the victims are winning, said Patrick Boyle in CNN.com. Increased awareness has driven a cultural shift in which kids are more likely to report abuse and to be believed. Youth organizations are running more background checks and enforcing mandatory reporting. That offers little solace to the many victims who were long ignored, but it is an important step toward preventing such horrors in the future. The next article is entitled Nuclear Talks with Iran. The White House and Iran have secretly agreed to hold one-on-one talks over the Islamic Republic's nuclear program after the election, the New York Times reported. Citing unnamed administration officials, the Times said that the two countries had agreed in principle to direct negotiations, an indication that stringent economic sanctions are weakening the regime's resolve to defy the world on its nuclear program. President Obama dismissed the report as not true, and Iranian Foreign Minister Ali Akbar Salahi denied any discussions or negotiations with America. But Times executive editor Jill Abramson stood by the reporting and insisted the story was solid and true. We'll go with the New York Times on this one, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. A top administration official probably hoped news of this deal would boost Obama's reputation with voters as a peacemaker. But what the leak really shows is the president's incredible naivete. The mullahs made this bow to diplomacy just to buy more time and get still closer to having a bomb. They've made 4 years of progress on this president's watch and will get four more if he is reelected. Actually, if this report is true, it shows Iran's leaders are getting scared, said Mike Schuster in NPR.org. The sanctions orchestrated by Washington and the oil embargo led by the European Union have thrown the country's economy into chaos. The bottom fell out of its currency, the rial, a couple of weeks ago, provoking street protests. The Iranian regime wants talks because it realizes that its very survival is at stake if the economy keeps disintegrating and protests grow more violent. Whether it's Obama or Romney, the winner on November 6th will have no choice but to try direct talks with Iran, said Tony Karen in Time.com. Both men know the American people are tired of war and won't tolerate an open-ended conflict that puts the world economy at risk because of potential impacts on oil prices. The only solution is to sustain the pressure on Iran through sanctions and hope that the mullahs can be talked out of pursuing their atomic ambitions. And now from the main story section of the Week magazine, we'll turn to the controversy of the week. Ohio, the state that'll decide the election. I am not sure whether to be congratulating you or consoling you if you happen to be reading this in Toledo, said Nate Silver in the New York Times. But the final 2 weeks of the presidential race are going to be all about you. No candidate has won the presidency without winning Ohio since 1960. And given the realities of this year's Electoral College map, it's very hard to see how either President Obama or Mitt Romney will be sworn in next January unless they win Ohio's 18 electoral votes. It was Obama's healthy 6-to-8-point lead in Ohio that had many pundits writing off Romney's candidacy in late September. But since the president's disastrous first debate performance, his lead there has shrunk to a mere 2 points. It will all come down to Ohio's white working-class voters, said David Walford in the Weekly Standard. Obama is counting on his bailout of General Motors and Chrysler to win their support. But these are also the same socially conservative voters Obama once dismissed as clinging to their guns and religion, and they aren't comfortable with the Democrats' liberal policies on gay marriage, abortion, and other social issues. So as a very close election enters its final days, Obama and Romney are pleading for Ohio's votes with the insistence of a determined suitor. Obama's lead in Ohio has shrunk, said John Cassidy in NewYorker.com, but it's not gone. The Obama campaign knew all along that Ohio's blue-collar votes would be pivotal and was running ads portraying Mitt Romney as an out-of-touch, factory-closing plutocrat before he'd even won his party's nomination. The GOP nominee has done his best to fight back, but polls suggest that all the money and manpower that Romney has thrown into Ohio haven't yet made much of a difference. Ohioans credit Obama with saving the auto industry, said Jerry Hirsch in the Los Angeles Times, which accounts for 12.4% of the state's jobs. More than all the ads and campaign stops, that single piece of policy alone may determine the next president. The auto bailout may not bail out Obama, said Rosalind Helderman in the Washington Post. The brightening economy in Ohio has ironically changed the focus of many conservative-leaning voters to federal spending and the rising tide of red ink. Voters once again are in the mood for a change. In 2008, said Josh Jordan in NationalReview.com, Obama won the state by only 4.6%, based on a healthy lead among independents and a highly enthusiastic base. Independents now favor Romney, and the Republican voters have the clear edge in enthusiasm. So a late surge could put Ohio in Romney's column and propel him into the White House. "It's all going to come down to momentum," said Glenn Thrush and Jonathan Martin in Politico.com. Romney's campaign is convinced that, like Ronald Reagan in 1980, he'll ride a late-breaking decisive wave that will carry him to victory in Ohio and several other battleground states, including Virginia, Florida, and Wisconsin. Obama's team is playing defense, bringing in Bruce Springsteen and Bill Clinton to campaign in Ohio, and hoping to eke out a narrow victory in the state with a strong get-out-the-vote effort and a late flood of negative TV ads. Romney, the ad says, is not one of us. If Ohioans agree, Obama gets a second term. If they don't, he's toast. And Chicago knows it. Now we'll turn to the popular column in the Week magazine called A Good Week For and A Bad Week For. It was a good week for hope after a study by Career Builder found that 69% of full-time workers regularly search for new jobs. It was a good week for seeing ghosts after Gilberto Araújo of Alagoas, Brazil, showed up at his own funeral, causing several mourners to faint. His family had mistakenly identified a different body at the morgue as his. "I said, 'Guys, I'm alive. Pinch me,' Araújo said. Signs from above. It's a good week for those after a meteor struck the California home of Kent Weber, pastor of a Presbyterian church. It's like the heavens coming down and the pastor's wife, Lisa. How cool," said the pastor's wife, Lisa. "How cool is that?" It was a bad week for ingratitude after police in Syracuse, New York, arrested 28-year-old Arthur Bundridge when he returned to a bank he allegedly had just robbed. Bundridge wanted to complain that he wasn't given the entire $20,000 he had demanded. It was a bad week for taking the kids to the movies after children and parents fled in shock when a British movie theater accidentally screened Paranormal Activity 4, a horror movie instead of a kiddie flick. "It was only about 2 minutes worth of the film, but it was enough to scar them for life," said parent Natasha Lewis. And it was a bad week for the literal-minded. After a caller named Donna complained to a North Dakota radio station about the placement of deer crossing signs on busy roads, saying they should direct deer to cross in less traveled areas. After a few days of public mockery, Donna received a call back from the station. "I feel so stupid," she said. "I had no clue that these signs were actually for us." Now, from the Week magazine, we'll turn to the briefing section. The briefing article this week is entitled, "To Circumcise or Not to Circumcise." A practice that's been a religious obligation for millennia is now in dispute. Is circumcision mutilation? How did the practice start? The Egyptians were removing the foreskins of young boys as early as 2400 BC, but the origins of circumcision remain a mystery. "It's like asking the question, where did religion come from?" said medical historian David Gollaher. "Jews have performed the ritual on eight-day-old boys for at least 3,000 years in accordance with God's commandment to Abraham that circumcising the flesh of your foreskins shall be a sign of the covenant between you and me." Muslims consider circumcision a purification ritual that can be performed on males of any age, and some African societies initiate pubescent boys into manhood through a circumcision ritual that tests their ability to withstand pain. For Americans, starting in the late 19th century, circumcision was touted as a cure for nervousness, masturbation, and imbecility. It remains a routine procedure in the U.S., with more than half of all boys circumcised, far more than in Europe. Does the operation have real health benefits? Three recent large-scale studies of African men have found that circumcision markedly lowers the risk of infection with HIV, the virus that causes AIDS. It also reduces infection from other sexually transmitted diseases, including the cancer-causing human papillomavirus, HPV as it's called. Researchers say that's because the foreskin can develop microscopic tears during sexual activity, allowing infections to more easily reach the bloodstream. Circumcision has also been found to reduce the risk of urinary tract infections in a baby's first year. Citing those studies, the American Academy on Pediatrics in August shifted its previously neutral stance on circumcision and announced that the procedure has significant health benefits. For every 909 circumcisions, the pediatricians reported, one man will be spared a diagnosis of penile cancer. So why do some people oppose it? Many frame their opposition to circumcision as a human rights issue. They see removing a healthy part of a newborn baby without his consent as an involuntary form of mutilation, a violation of medical ethics. Babies should be left alone, said Georgianne Chapin of the anti-circumcision group Intact America. When they become men, they can make their own informed decision about whether they want to remove a part of their own penises. Chapin and other so-called inactivists dispute the evidence of circumcision's medical benefits. Infection can be prevented with proper hygiene and condoms, they claim, and point to the pain involved and the risks of bleeding, infection, and other complications. Some critics also maintain that circumcision makes the penis less sensitive, robbing men of the full range of sexual pleasure. Inactivists seek to change society's attitudes about the operation with the goal, according to movement leader Matthew Hess, of making cutting boys' foreskin a federal crime. Have they made progress? The procedure is definitely becoming less prevalent. Rates of hospital circumcision in the U.S. have dropped from a high of about 79% in the 1970s to 55% in 2010, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. That may be partly because Medicaid has stopped paying for the surgery in 18 states. Some insurance companies also have stopped covering it. In addition, Latin American immigrants tend not to circumcise. But another reason for the decline is that the moral argument against circumcision is swaying many American parents. In San Francisco last year, 12,000 citizens supported a ballot initiative that would have made circumcision a misdemeanor, punishable by a fine of up to $1,000 or a year in jail. A judge blocked the referendum on a technicality, but the band's sponsor, Lloyd Schofield, claimed victory. Just getting people to think and discuss, this is a very rewarding time, he said. And this year in Cologne, Germany, a regional court ruled that the botched ritual circumcision of a 4-year-old Muslim boy amounted to assault, and the German Medical Association counseled doctors to stop performing the operation. How have religions responded? Across Germany, furious protests by religious Jews and Muslims prompted lawmakers to draft a law making circumcision explicitly legal as long as it is carried out by trained experts and parents are informed of medical risks. A similar clash ignited this summer in New York City after city health officials found that in the last decade, 11 baby boys there had contracted herpes infections and two of them had died. Through a rare Orthodox Jewish rite called Metesah B'peh, in which the Mohel, who performs the ritual circumcision, sucks the blood directly from the fresh wound. The city's Board of Health proposed making parents sign a form laying out the medical risks, but ultra-Orthodox Jewish leaders vowed to defy the order and and last week won a temporary injunction. New parents not bound by religious custom, meanwhile, are facing the circumcision decision with considerable doubt and confusion. Circumcision does have a medical benefit, says Dr. Doug Dikema, who took part in the American Academy of Pediatrics task force on the procedure. Not everyone would trade that foreskin for that medical benefit. It's a hard decision, and there are good reasons for almost any decision you want to make. And the footnote from this particular article here is called The Life of a Mohel. Max Mintz has circumcised more than 9,700 babies during the past 30 years, and he expects to hit the 10,000 mark by year's end. A retired Houston-area pediatrician, he performs the ritual for Jewish families in Texas and across the country, and will happily circumcise non-Jewish babies, too. Mintz, who charges about $350 for his services, says the procedure takes about a minute, involving a deft cut with a ritual knife called an Ismael. If you know how to do something surgically, just changing to another instrument is not so difficult, Mintz said. And the ritual method is so much simpler. An Orthodox Jew, Mintz is gratified to be able to marry his faith with his surgical skills, and performing a bris, the Hebrew word for circumcision, is always a very happy occasion, he said. I don't have to do funerals like a rabbi. Everybody wants to meet you. And you are listening to our Reading of the Week magazine for the week November 2nd, 2012. Thanks so much for joining me today on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Now we're going to turn to the best columns of the U.S. as determined by the Week magazine for this past week. The first column is entitled, Suddenly Everyone is Middle Class, by Sophie Quinton in the National Journal. Our presidential candidates can agree on at least one thing, said Sophie Quinton. This election is all about the middle class. But if you listen to how they define it, apparently 4 out of 5 Americans fall in the middle class. For taxation purposes, both Obama and Romney have arbitrarily selected $250,000 as the upper limit of what they consider a middle-class income. Yet only 2% of Americans make more than $250,000. If you assume that about 15% are poor and 2% are rich, that means 83% are middle-class, a very broad definition. Researchers say the true middle class makes somewhere in the vicinity of the median family income of $62,273. For most Americans, though, the middle class is a state of mind, defined by owning a home or wanting to make enough money to buy a car or two and educate their kids, and aspiring to do just a little bit better. That explains why politicians all profess to be champions of the middle class, whether they earn $20,000 or $200,000. Pretty much everyone thinks the candidates are talking about them. The next column is entitled A Nation Addicted to Welfare, by Robert Rector and Rachel Sheffield in NationalReview.com. Welfare spending has hit a stunning all-time high, said Robert Rector and Rachel Sheffield. State and federal spending on about 80 means-tested welfare programs now costs taxpayers about $1 trillion a year, providing cash, food, housing, medical care, and social services to about 100 million lower-income Americans. That's right, 1 out of 3 people is now on the dole, and they get an average of $9,000 apiece every year. This does not include what we spend on Medicare or Social Security. Liberals equate this massive welfare state with helping the poor, but creating dependency on this scale is no way to promote the authentic well-being of Americans. In launching his original War on Poverty, President Lyndon Johnson said his goal was to make people self-sufficient, but $19 trillion in welfare spending later, our nation is further than ever from that original goal. To break the self-defeating cycle of dependency, all aid programs should copy the welfare reform program of the 1990s and require recipients to work in return for their government handouts. When government gives people something for nothing, it isn't helping them. It's teaching them to do nothing. And our third column here for this week from the Week magazine is called We Deny Science at Our Peril. And it's written by Sean Lawrence Otto in the Scientific American. American democracy is slipping off its foundation of science, said Sean Lawrence Otto. Founding fathers such as Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin strongly favored knowledge gained by systematic study over the assertions of ideology, and America's scientific innovation made us the envy of the world for generations. It was America that pioneered automation and electrification in medicine and biotech, in space and in tech. But now the country is being swept by science denialism. Republicans, sorry to say, are the worst offenders, with the party's candidates denying evolution, human-induced climate change, and even the fact that rape can lead to pregnancy. The GOP has taken on an anti-intellectual cast, with an authoritarian demand for ideological conformity, regardless of what the facts say. Democrats are not wholly innocent. Liberals indulge in pseudoscientific fear-mongering about vaccines, cell phones, and anything that's not natural. When neither side accepts any objective test of truth, public discourse is reduced to endless warring opinions. We then wind up with policies that are determined by the loudest voices. We will flip to the back of the magazine for a reading of The Last Word from the Week magazine this week. And since this is the week of Halloween, I guess this is a particularly appropriate column. The Last Word this week is entitled New England's Vampire Panic. In 19th century Rhode Island, says Abigail Tucker, farmers began digging up graves in search of vampires. Children playing near a hillside gravel mine found the first graves. One ran home to tell his mother, who was skeptical at first, until the boy produced a skull. Because this was Griswold, Connecticut, in 1990, police initially thought the burials might be the work of a local serial killer named Michael Ross, who had been sent to death row in 1987, and they taped off the area as a crime scene. But the brown, decaying bones turned out to be more than a century old. The Connecticut State archaeologist Nick Bellatoni soon determined that the hillside contained a colonial-era farm cemetery. New England is full of such unmarked family plots, and the 29 burials were typical of the 1700s and early 1800s. The dead, many of them children, were laid to rest in thrifty Yankee style, in simple wood coffins without jewelry or even much clothing, their arms resting by their sides or crossed over their chests. Except that is for burial number 4, which is one of the only two stone crypts in the cemetery. Scraping away soil with flat-edged shovels and then brushes and bamboo picks, the archaeologist and his team worked through several feet of earth before reaching the top of the crypt. When Bellantoni lifted the first of the large flat rocks that formed the roof, he recovered the remains of a red-painted coffin and a pair of skeletal feet. They lay, he remembers, in perfect anatomical position. But when he raised the next stone, Bellantoni saw that the rest of the individual had been completely rearranged. The skeleton had been beheaded. Skull and thigh bones rested atop the ribs and vertebrae. It looked like a skull and crossbones motif, a Jolly Roger. I'd never seen anything like it, Bellantoni recalls. Subsequent analysis showed that the beheading, along with other injuries, including rib fractures, occurred roughly 5 years after death. The other skeletons in the gravel hillside were packaged for reburial, but not J.B., as the 50-ish male skeleton from the 1830s came to be called, because of the initials spelled out in brass tacks on his coffin lid. He was shipped to the National Museum of Health and Medicine in Washington, D.C. for further study. Meanwhile, Bell and Tony started networking. He invited archaeologists and historians to tour the excavation, soliciting theories. Simple vandalism seemed unlikely, as did robbery, because of the lack of valuables at the site. Finally, one colleague asked, "Ever heard of the Jewett City vampires?" In 1854, Indiana, in neighboring Jewett City, Connecticut, townspeople had exhumed several corpses suspected to be vampires that were rising from their graves to kill the living. A few newspaper accounts of these events survived. Had the Griswold grave been desecrated for the same reason? In the course of his far-flung research, Bell and Tony placed a phone call to Michael Bell, a Rhode Island folklorist who had devoted much of the previous decade to studying New England vampire exhumations. The Griswold case occurred at roughly the same time as the other incidents Bell had investigated. And the setting was right. Griswold was rural, agrarian, and bordering southern Rhode Island, where multiple exhumations had occurred. Many of the other vampires, like J.B., had been disinterred, grotesquely tampered with, and reburied. In light of the tales Bell told of violated corpses, even the posthumous rib fractures began to make sense. J.B.'s accusers had likely rummaged around in his chest cavity, hoping to remove and perhaps to burn his heart. Almost two decades after J.B.'s grave was discovered, it remains the only intact archaeological clue to the fear that swept the region. In part because the events were relatively recent, evidence of historic vampires isn't as scarce as one might imagine. Incredulous city newspaper reporters dished about the horrible superstition on front pages. A traveling minister describes an exhumation in his daily log on September 3, 1810. The moldy spectacle, he writes, was a solemn sight. Though scholars today still struggle to explain the vampire panics, a key detail unites them. The public hysteria almost invariably occurred in the midst of savage tuberculosis outbreaks. Indeed, the medical museum's tests ultimately reveal that J.B. had suffered from tuberculosis or a lung disease very like it. Typically, a rural family contracted the wasting illness, and even though they often received the standard medical diagnosis, the survivors blamed early victims as vampires who preyed upon family members who subsequently fell sick. Often an exhumation was called for to stop the vampire's predations. Often these rituals were clandestine, lantern-lit affairs. But particularly in Vermont, they could be quite public, even festive. One vampire heart was reportedly torched on the Woodstock, Vermont town green in 1830. In Manchester, hundreds of people flocked to a 1793 heart-burning ceremony at a blacksmith's forge. Timothy Meade officiated at the altar in the sacrifice to the demon vampire, who it was believed was still sucking the blood of the then-living wife of Captain Burton, an early town history said. It was the month of February and good slaying. 2 days before Halloween, Michael Bell and I head through forests of swamp, maple, and swamp oak to Exeter, Rhode Island, where New England's most famous vampire died. History knows the 19-year-old late 19th century vampire as Mercy Brown. Her family called her Lena. She lived and died in deserted Exeter, as it was dubbed, or simply one of the border towns. An early northeaster is brewing as we pull into the parking lot of the Chestnut Hill Baptist Church in front of Lena's cemetery. The heavy rain will soon turn to snow, and there's a bullying wind. Our umbrellas bloom inside out like black flowers. Though it's a somber place, there's no immediate clue that an accused vampire is buried here. Unlike Salem, Exeter doesn't promote its dark claim to fame and remains in some respects an insular community. Old-timers don't like the hooded figures who turn up this time of year or the cars idling with the lights off. They say the legend should be left alone, perhaps with good reason. Last summer, a couple of teenagers were killed on a pilgrimage to Lena's grave when they lost control of their car on Purgatory Road. Most vampire graves stand apart in wooded spots outside modern cemetery fences, where snow melts slowly and there's a thick understory of ferns. But the Chestnut Hill Cemetery is still in use, and here is Lena. She lies beside the brother who was fed the ashes of her heart in an attempt to cure him of consumption, and the father who let it happen. Other markers are freckled with lichen, but not hers. The stone looks to have been recently cleaned. It has been stolen over the years, and now an iron strap anchors it to the earth. How did 19th-century Yankees, remembered as the most pious and practical of peoples, come to believe in vampires, especially when the last known vampire panics at the time occurred in 18th-century Europe? Well, some modern scholars have linked the legend of vampires to symptoms of diseases like rabies and porphyry, a rare genetic disorder that can cause extreme sensitivity to sunlight and turns teeth a reddish brown. Exeter residents at the time claim that the exhumations were a tradition of the Indians. The legend originated in Slavic Europe, where the word vampire first appeared in the 10th century. Bell believes that Slavic and Germanic immigrants brought vampire superstitions with them in the 1700s, perhaps with the Palatine Germans colonized Pennsylvania, or when Hessian mercenaries served in the Revolutionary War. My sense is that it came more than one time through more than one source, he says. But some modern scholars have argued that the vampire superstition made a certain degree of practical sense. In Vampires, Burial and Death, folklorist Paul Barber dissects the logic behind vampire myths, which he believes originally arose from unschooled but astute observations of decay. Bloated dead bodies appear as if they have recently eaten, for instance. The seemingly bizarre vampire beliefs, Barber argues, get the essence of contagion, the insight that illness begets illness and death, death. While New England's farmers may have been guided by something like reason, the spiritual climate of the day was also hospitable to vampire rumors. Contrary to their puritanical reputation, rural New Englanders in the 1800s were a fairly heathen lot. Only about 10% belonged to a church. Rhode Island, originally founded as a haven for religious dissenters, was particularly lax. Christian missionaries were at various points dispatched there from more godly communities. The missionaries come back and lament that there's no Bible in the home, no church going whatsoever, says Linford Fisher, a Brown University colonial historian. You have people out there essentially in cultural isolation. In place of organized worship, superstitions reigned. Magical springs with healing powers. Dead bodies that bled in the presence of their murderers. People buried shoes by fireplaces to catch the devil if he tried to come down the chimney. They nailed horseshoes above doors to ward off evil and carved daisy wheels, a kind of colonial hex sign, into door frames. If superstition likely fanned the vampire panics, perhaps the most powerful forces at play were communal and social. By 1893, there were just 17 people per square mile in Exeter. A fifth of the farms were fully abandoned, the fields turning slowly back into forest. In her monograph, The New England Vampire Belief, Image of the Decline, Gothic literature scholar Fay Ringle Hazel hints at a vampire metaphor behind the Western hemorrhage. The migration seemed to drain rural New England of its most enterprising young citizens, leaving the old and unfit behind. As Exeter teetered near collapse, maintaining social ties must have taken on new importance. An exhumation represented, first and foremost, a sad duty to one's own kin. The ritual would alleviate the guilt someone might feel for not doing everything they could to save a family, to leave no stone unturned, Bell says. Even more significant in small communities where disease could spread quickly, an exhumation was an outward display that you are doing everything you can to fix the problem. Residents of the already beleaguered town were likely terrified. They knew that if consummation wiped out the Brown family, if consumption wiped out the Brown family, it could take out the next family, Bell says. Lena's father, George Brown, had to make a gesture. The strongest testament to the power of the vampire myth is that George Brown did not, in fact, believe in it. It was he who asked a doctor to perform the autopsy of his daughter at the graveyard, and he who elected to be elsewhere during the ritual. He authorized his loved one's exhumation, the Providence Journal says, simply to satisfy the neighbors who were, according to another newspaper account, worrying the life out of him. Perhaps it was wise to let them have their way, since George Brown, apparently not prone to tuberculosis, had to coexist with his neighbors well into the next century. He died in 1922. And that article was copyrighted in 2012 by the Smithsonian Institution and reprinted in the Week magazine with permission from Smithsonian Enterprises. Now, from the Week magazine for this week, let's take a look at an article from the Health and Science section here. The article is entitled, Born to Poverty or Success? Climbing from poverty to success is no easier in the United States than it is in China, England, or many other countries. It's also no easier today than it was 200 years ago. Those are the surprising conclusions of researchers who used international historical records to track the wealth, education, and life expectancy of people with the same family names from 1800 to the present. In this study of social mobility, researchers expected the average family's fortunes to have shifted dramatically in 200 years, but they found the opposite. Whether you're from Chile, China, England, Japan, Sweden, or the U.S., if people with your surname in 1800 were members of the elite, you're likely to be elite too. If your family name was linked to poverty back then, odds are it still is. As much as 60% of our social status is determined at the time of conception, economic historian Gregory Clark of the University of California, Davis, tells NPR.org. What's really shocking about this finding, says Northwestern University economic historian Joseph Ferry, is that the number is as constant as it is. In fact, when researchers looked even farther back in the record books, they found that the speed of social mobility hasn't changed since the Middle Ages. And from the Health and Science section, the health scare of the week, younger stroke victims. Young people are having more strokes than they did 20 years ago, new research shows. Nearly one out of every five people who suffer a stroke is now under the age of 55, a rate 6% higher than in the early 1990s. And the average age of stroke victims overall has fallen from 71 to 69. Our data cannot tell us why exactly this is happening, University of Cincinnati neurologist Brett Kisla tells WebMD.com, but the trend is getting worse over time. Experts say the rise in strokes among younger people is especially surprising, given that stroke rates have declined among people over the age of 55. One reason for the shift may be that Americans are developing risk factors like obesity, diabetes, and high blood pressure at younger ages. A balanced diet, exercise, and regular medical checkups can all reduce stroke risk. Now we'll turn to the Talking Points section of the Week magazine. Our first article here is entitled, Texas Cheerleaders Mixing Faith and Football. In Texas, high school football is already a religion, said Araminta Woodsworth in NationalPost.com. So it's hardly surprising that cheerleaders at Kearnsey High in East Texas would enlist the aid of God in support of their team. The cheerleaders decorated their home field with spirit banners inscribed with biblical verses, including, I can do all things through Christ. The players take the field by crashing through a banner that reads, If God is for us, who can be against us? The Freedom From Religion Foundation threatened to sue, and Kansas school superintendent ordered the banners removed. But a state judge blocked enforcement of the school district's order, and Governor Rick Perry declared the ruling a victory for all who cherish our inalienable right to freedom of speech and religious expression. Liberal organizations, of course, were outraged, said Jonathan Zimmerman in the Los Angeles Times, but they've got this one wrong. Yes, the banners were displayed at a school event, but they were made and paid for by the cheerleaders, not the school itself. So this isn't a church-state case at all. The girls were expressing their own views, and the First Amendment guarantees not only the free expression of religion, but the freedom of speech, writ large. Instead of trying to censor the cheerleaders, liberals should protect all student speech, no matter how pious or impious it might sound. That's the sentiment down here in Kansas, said Penn Dexter in ChristianPost.com. The cheerleaders' Facebook page has 48,000 members, and no one opposes the banners, except a few outsiders who favor attacks on religious freedom. Whose religious freedom? Asked Michael Stone in Examiner.com. Clearly, the cheerleaders want to promote Christianity at public school events. Cheerleading for the school team is undeniably a school-sponsored activity, so this official endorsement of a particular religion is unconstitutional. It's a growing problem in Texas, said the New York Times in an editorial. The American Civil Liberties Union has found aggressive championing of Christian beliefs in state classrooms, assemblies, and graduation ceremonies. Those who object are being cowed by an atmosphere of intimidation and even fear. That's un-American. Even in Texas, the Constitution does not leave religious freedom up to the majority rule. And election 2012, the nightmare scenarios. The election result nobody wants is looking more likely by the day, said David Jackson in USA Today. As it stands now, Mitt Romney and President Obama are locked in a virtual tie at 47% each, according to the RealClearPolitics.com poll of polls. But Obama still has a narrow lead in several crucial swing states, including New Hampshire, Wisconsin, and Ohio, giving him a better chance of assembling the 270 electoral votes needed to win the White House. If that split holds until Election Day, Romney could win the popular vote, but lose the electoral vote and the presidency to Obama. Please, whatever happens November 6, not that, said Jay Bookman in AJC.com. It was bad enough in 2000 when the Supreme Court had to decide the election in Bush versus Gore, but America is now an even more partisan and divided nation with momentous budgetary tax and foreign policy decisions to make. We need a clear-cut winner in the White House, not somebody installed there thanks to a quirky electoral college. Actually, we could be in for something even worse than a repeat of 2000, said Elliot Spitzer in Slate.com. If the vote is very close, it's entirely possible that the Electoral College tally will be tied, with Obama and Romney each getting 269 votes. If that happens, America would get a complicated, tension-filled lesson in the Constitution. The House of Representatives would vote to determine who wins, with the states getting just one vote apiece. So New York's 29 members would get one vote, the same as North Dakota's single congressman. That would mean a Romney win, as the little populated red states outnumber the highly populated blue states. The constitutional craziness doesn't end there, said Philip Klein in WashingtonExaminer.com. In the event of an electoral college tie, the Senate gets to pick the vice president. That means if Democrats hold on to their Senate majority, Joe Biden would be Romney's vice president. How's that for fun? Only one good result could come from another electoral disaster, said Garrett Epps in the Atlantic.com. Americans might finally fix our electoral system so this won't happen over and over. Abolishing the Electoral College and ushering in a true democracy is the only logical response. Sadly, small states will object to any change that would diminish their outsized power. So election reform is likely to remain a dream, even if Election Day 2012 turns into a nightmare. We'll know what happens next week, won't we? Now let's take a look at a few short items here in the Talking Points section as we close the program. People who work in industries that skew male, such as construction, mining, petroleum, and utilities, are much more likely to support Mitt Romney in this election, according to a survey by PayScale, a private salary survey company. Those who work in education, the arts and entertainment, media, and tech are more likely to support President Obama. U.S. cities are facing a smartphone crime wave. San Francisco says that half of all robberies are phone-related, while in New York City, it's 40%. If the White House were put up for sale on the real estate market, it would fetch a price of around $1.5 billion, say real estate analysts. Frequent renovations, 13 bedrooms, 35 bathrooms, and an ideal location would justify the colossal asking price, though the frequent resident turnover might put off some potential buyers. Legal Colorado marijuana vendors sell about $200 million of weed every year to 100,000 state residents who've gotten prescriptions for medical reasons. Colorado is one of three states, with Washington and Oregon, that will vote in November on a referendum on full legalization of marijuana. And the poll watch for this week, 54% of Americans say it is more important to have stable governments in the Middle East, even if it means less democracy. 30% say it's more important to have democratic governments. By 63% to 23%, Americans want the U.S. to be less involved rather than more involved in the region's political changes. We've just about run out of time for today's episode of The Week Magazine. Be sure to listen again next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week Magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. So long until next time.